Hello and welcome to another episode in the New Books and Gender Studies podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Kyle McMillan, and today I am pleased to be joined by Dr. Angus McLaren with his new book, Playboys and Mayfair Men, Crime, Class, Masculinity, and Fascism in 1930s London. Professor, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
So I thought we could start out with just discussing your academic career, your academic trajectory, and sort of what led you to write this book in particular.
Yes, well, I began my career began on a sort of sour note in that my PhD, which was finished in 1970, was a really old-fashioned sort of political history. And I was filling a gap, so to speak, in the political history of 19th century France. But at my last year at Harvard, Theodore Zeldin from Oxford came through and was doing a completely different take on the history of France by looking at issues such as sex and gender and consumerism. And I realized that I could do something much more interesting. And so I dropped political history. And my first book was on the history of birth control in 19th century England. And that was launched largely because I was struck by the fact that perhaps the most important social change in Western world in the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th centuries was the decline in the birth rate. And yet it was an issue that had not been adequately investigated by scholars. And this led me into a number of books on history of contraception, history of abortion, and eugenics. But I've also produced a few books that have made the attempt to be so-called crossover books to try to attract a larger audience to history. And I sort of locate this book on Playboys to this attempt to use a sensational case as a hook on which to describe the social changes that were taking place in Britain in the 1930s.
Yeah, and I guess let's start there. So let's talk about the crime itself and sort of what happened at the Hyde Park Hotel that you sort of opened the book with.
Right. Well, I guess I might begin by saying that one of the curious and sort of minor issues that led me to this particular case was the fact that you had four young men, all from good families, who, according to the press, used a life preserver to attack a diamond salesman. And this didn't make no sense to me, a life preserver, but I discovered that life preserver was the term used by the British for a blackjack, and it preserved the life, presumably, of the person who was being attacked. And I was sort of curious about this and pursued the story of this particular robbery. And then my appetite was stimulated by the fact that the press referred to these four criminals as playboys. And I was sort of taken aback by this, and I never really thought about the notion that the term playboy had a history. And one always associates it with, of course, Hugh Hefner in the 1950s. But here in the 1930s, you had these sort of layabouts being called playboys and, in fact, embracing the term. I've wandered away a bit from your original question. What was it again?
So what exactly, you know, happened at the Hyde Park Hotel? What was the crime that was committed by these four men?
Well, the crime was that these four men, all from respectable families, all well-educated, in their early 20s, decided to rob a diamond salesman, one of the representatives of the Cartier, the world's most famous diamond company. So they checked into this luxurious hotel near Hyde Park, the Hyde Park Hotel, and then phoned up Cartier's and asked that a range of diamonds, about 9 diamond rings, be sent over to the hotel room where they could be appraised. And the man making the phone call pretended to be a member of a wealthy banking family. And his argument was that he was going to use these diamonds as part of a marriage settlement for his upcoming wedding with a rich woman. And so this diamond representative put on his coat and in his pocket, he carried 9 diamonds, which would be worth about £500,000 today, and extraordinarily walked across Hyde Park to the hotel, and there was attacked by these fellows, beaten over the head with the life preserver, and his diamonds taken from him, and they fled into West London.
Yeah, so one of the, I thought, curious parts of your description of the crime and sort of the investigation and the trial was that all the hotel employees seemed to describe these 4 men as effeminate in their sort of witness testimony. So why was that? Why were they describing them this way?
Yes, it's a very good question, because I've discovered quite quickly that these 4 people were, on the one hand, sort of womanizers. They all married at least once, if not more frequently, and were associated with, playboys were associated with men preying on women. The hotel workers, that is to say the maids and the waiters, almost all described them, these men as being effeminate. And it occurred to me that what they really were talking about was that men who were taking what was supposed to be an undue interest in their presentation of self, with immaculately well-dressed, good teeth, polished shoes, glossy hair, and this notion that any man, any heterosexual man who took too great an interest in his clothing or style was suspect.
You know, I think this kind of leads into one of the other questions I had, but early on in, I believe in your introduction, you say that the 1930s was, and I'm quoting here, a period in which a generation of young men and women renegotiated their identities. So why was this happening in 1930s Britain?
Well, in some ways, it was still a reverberation of the First World War. Of course, the 1920s had seen the first response to the war, the great bloodletting, which had led to a sort of a rebound to the emergence of the flapper and the sort of popular notion of the 1920s being a period of revolt against the stodgy Victorian age that World War I had brought an end to. In the 1930s, you have young men who, most of them were only born in about 1910, and that is to say of the people I'm looking at, but they, in a sense, didn't have the excuse of their older generation who had faced the prospect of actually serving in the war. And the change in the relationships of the sexes, one aspect of that was the continued decline of the birth rate, that marriage itself was no longer simply regarded as something as an institution to have children as its main duty, but that the relationship between the sexes was increasingly based on sexuality. You have people like Mary Stopes, the British birth controller, stressing the necessity for having compatible couples and having young men and women who knew each other far more closely than had been the case with their forebears. The Depression as well led to reappraisals of modernization. Britain was increasingly influenced by American culture, American movies being one of the main vehicles of this cultural invasion. And amongst the upper classes, there was a certain repugnance for things American, which that is to say of a mass society, of consumerism, of a lack of deference to natural elites. But on the grassroots level, so to speak, as you have the increased activities of women in the labor force, they have a greater degree of self-confidence. In England, of course, the flapper vote had been passed in 1928, so that men and women, in theory, now were at least equal in the question of electoral politics. The fact is, however, that in the culture, they wanted it both ways. You still have popular accounts of rebellious women in the conclusion of novels and plays being brought to heel, there's limits that have to be drawn. But clearly there was an enormous questioning of what the relationship was between the sexes. It had by no means had been ultimately decided.
Right. And so now that we sort of have a macro view of what was happening between the sexes, let's go a little bit more micro. So who were these four men in particular? Sort of, you know, you mentioned that they're from well-to-do families, but exactly like what were their backstories?
Well, they're four young men, as I mentioned, between the ages, I think, of 22 and 26. Two of them were the sons of military officers, one a colonel, one a captain, I believe. One was the son of a wealthy textile manufacturer. And the final fourth man, his father was a successful businessman in the city of London. They all came from what one would call upper-class families. They had links to the aristocracy amongst their networks of friends. They all were educated. They went to good schools like Harrow and Westminster, Oundle. And they had a network of relationships that put them in the position of feeling entitled, that they came from well-to-do families and sort of assumed that naturally enough they would be taken care of one way or another.
Right. And so I thought, you know, you kind of brought up parallels to the flapper earlier in our conversation. And I thought, you know, I've heard that said about the flapper, that essentially the idea of the flapper was invented. And you kind of make a similar argument that the idea of the playboy was sort of invented during this time. So what kind of went into the invention of this idea?
Well, I think the invention was based on the notion that there was a sort of natural type of masculinity. And in very gross terms, the Victorian period has seen this sort of distant authoritarian patriarch, the man who had made all the decisions based on reason, and the wife, the woman, showing her deference to him. In the 20th century, historians have talked about the domestication, increased domestication of males, where the family was smaller, men spent more time at home, and took a greater interest and pride in their abilities as being good husbands and good fathers. Now, the playboy, though, was a sort of dissident type of masculinity. There had always been men, sometimes called dandies, sometimes called bloods, macaronis, who, in a sense, were on the margins of respectable society. They were especially prone to accentuate their difference from ordinary men by their casual disregard for middle-class mores, and their interest in dress and presentation of self. Now, the term playboy was an old term that referred, first of all, to young men, young boys who were players in the stage of the 17th century theater. And later on, it morphed into the term used to describe the sort of tricksters, especially in Irish society, and the playboy of the Western world by Singh popularized the term in the early 20th century. But it took on its exploitative and sexual nature in the 1930s. First of all, in America, and indeed by the 1920s, and then in Britain. And I guess the main issue of it was the term boy, that the essence of the playboy was someone who wasn't fully mature, was not yet a respectable member of adult male society. Excuse me. So we find that, for example, in America, Roosevelt, in trying to goad the Americans into entering World War II, said that the Americans were viewed as playboys because they had the Russians and the British doing their fighting for them. He wasn't talking about their sexuality, but rather this immaturity that the term conjured up. So that we find with the playboy, he's sort of a projection of how far a man might go before he toppled over into, say, homosexuality. That both playboys and homosexuals were regarded as similar, in as much as they took too much of an interest in their own well-being. They weren't settling down. They were a sort of threat, in the first instance to women, because they were oftentimes out to exploit them, but also a threat to other men, in young men, that is to say, in providing a model of the man who lived by his wits, in catching funds, borrowing from friends, living off family, and not behaving as a proper Englishman should do.
You know, at the sort of conclusion of the, you know, eventual trial of these four men, you see a lot of, you know, instances of them being called playboys in the media. And so I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit how sort of around the conclusion of the trial, and maybe if you want to go into sort of what exactly the consequences were for this crime for these four men. But in what ways were they sort of, what ways were the media or members of the media sort of using Playboy to interact with this this crime?
Yes, well, with the press, you have, of course, two main branches, the respectable broadsheets, the papers like the Times of London and the Observer. And then you have the red tops, the tabloids, which pandered to a much larger audience of sometimes with the Daily Mail, for example, having as many as 2 million subscribers. And the popular press was dependent upon stories of from the courts, sensational trials, and also enormous amount of gossipy material, much of it recording the activities of the royal family and the hangers-on. The Playboy suited the popular press because there was almost an insatiable appetite amongst the lower middle classes for stories about the foibles of the upper classes, of the toffs. It was a sense of class envy, perhaps. But it was always a surefire story if one could portray an upper-class man being brought low by having transgressed some particular statute or law. In the trial itself, the judge expressed the disgust of the respectable in viewing four young men who had gone to good schools but had gained nothing from their time spent there. Their schooling was only an evidence of the wealth of their families that had been able to send them to wealthy schools such as Harrow. And also contempt from young men who had made no real attempt to establish themselves professionally in life. This is perhaps brought out most clearly in the judges asking at one point, how long these men were in a particular hotel bar. And one of the accused said, well, we were there, we had two drinks. And the judge said, is this the way you measure time? He was horrified that they would be indifferent to respectable hours as kept by clocks, but rather based on their own personal well-being. So when they were all found guilty of conspiracy to commit robbery. One of the young men had not actually been at the scene of the crime, so was not convicted for robbery with violence as the other three were. And two of the four, the two who were responsible for holding down the salesman and for hitting him over the head with the blackjack, they were subjected not only to long prison terms, but also to being flogged, that is to say, being whipped by a cat of nine tails.
Right, and that kind of introduces a very interesting chapter at least to me, about how much the flogging of these men was sort of a big deal, you know, in British society, and sort of the discussion around, you know, pain and punishment and really sort of like criminal, the nature of criminal justice at the time. So I wondered if you wanted to dive into that a little bit.
Yes. Well, when I was trying to remember exactly how I got into writing this book. And I recall that I had dealt in an earlier book called Trials of Masculinity with the campaign for the end to corporal punishment in the 19th century. There was, Foucault talks about the fact that increasingly it was the mind that was the subject of rehabilitation rather than the body for punishment in the 19th century. And you see that there is a decline in the use of the whip across Europe. So when these two young men are sentenced to be flogged, there's horror. Now in Europe, there's again the notion that this is sort of shows British hypocrisy, because the British present themselves as a civilized race, and yet they are having recourse to this type of sort of medieval, one might use that term, punishment. And amongst the British themselves, many people didn't even realize that flogging still was on the books. It had been withdrawn from its use in the Navy and the military. And it had resurfaced as a type of punishment in the late 19th, early 20th century to deal with crimes that were considered to be especially shameful for men. And it would include things like robbery with violence, exhibitionism, and a few other sort of sexual misdemeanors or crimes. notion was originally that flogging was necessary because there were some people who were so degraded, some men who were so animalistic, that one could not appeal to the reason. One had to employ pain to get them to mend their ways. It's a type of retribution. But in the case of the Hyde Park Hotel robbers, these were intelligent young men who had gone to good schools, and so this argument didn't hold. But it seemed all the more horrific that such people should be subjected to such a brutal crime. It seemed, unworthy of British society.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that too leads into, the relationship between the upper classes and crime and the police. You kind of have a chapter that talks about sort of the tenuous at best relationship between the police and the upper classes at this time. And I kind of think that fits well with the discussion about, you know, who and for what gets, you know, flogged or, you know, that sort of punishment.
Yes, well, the relationships of the police and the public, again, is fascinating. On the one hand, it's this case makes clear the importance of having informers. It's something that is not often talked about in the histories of crime and policing, but an enormous amount of attention was paid to reports handed in by informers or informants. And indeed, one of the four accused men in this case had acted as an informer for the police just a month or so before he himself was arrested. There's also the case as well that comes out that when the police, as in this case, have to question or make inquiries amongst the upper classes, they are very cautious and deferential. And one police officer remembers a case in which, when he asked to investigate a house, search a house, the woman in charge of the house, an upper-class woman, he said, viewed him as someone who might be looking after the drains or the garbage, that the police were not viewed with awe by the upper classes, but rather seen to be carrying out a sort of unpleasant but necessary duty. So that the police again, had to sort of straddle these two sorts of separate worlds to exploit the working class criminals, using the old notion that it took a thief to catch a thief, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the cautiousness with which they dealt with the upper classes.
Yeah, and we've definitely been touching on class quite a bit in this discussion. One of the things that you sort of point out or use, I guess, in your analysis of how the story of the Playboys interacts with discussions of class in the 1930s London is sort of the geography of the city itself. So how did you use sort of how London geography to sort of talk about class in this case in particular?
Well, I guess one of the fascinating things about this particular case is the importance of Mayfair, this West London neighborhood, which was a sort of bastion of upper class wealth and power. There's been a whole rash of very important and useful books on the working class neighborhoods of London, especially East London. But not too much has been done, interestingly enough, on West London. And it's partly the repugnance in some ways of social historians to look at the wealthy. It's to sort of assume that one knows what's going on. It's all too clear. There's no secrets held by the upper classes. They're the subject of newspaper reports every day. But what I found again was that for these young men who are in some ways representative of their class, the upper 1% of the population, Mayfair was their London. This area bounded by Piccadilly and Regent Street, Oxford Street, and Hyde Park. It's striking that that's where they live, that's where they carried out their crimes, and in fact, that's where at least one of them is arrested. So it's a world unto itself. It's also the case that with Mayfair, the historian is, and its inhabitants, and the historian is sort of studying up rather than studying down, as one might do when looking at the working class. But in some ways, looking at the upper classes is easy because the Times of London carries every day its account of the doings of the rich and the powerful, of their birthdays, their celebrations, their promotions, their elections. There's a continuation of their presentation of self so that one can follow their family networks and have a good idea of who's related to whom. Now, as far as the class is concerned, again, one of the fears of the 1930s with the Great Depression is that classes are becoming, at least the lines between classes, is becoming eroded. Now, in reality, we know that there's an enormous disparity in wealth between the upper classes and the lower classes. But there was this notion of relative deprivation, that people in the upper classes were becoming what was called the new poor. That is to say, they found that the cost of servants was getting more and more expensive, that the cost of keeping their children in private schools was becoming exorbitant. Now, there was this vast gap between the upper classes and the mass of the population. But there was a sense that there was a whittling away and erosion of these disparities. The Mayfair men, in part, exploited these sorts of fears in their defense, arguing, for example, that once upon a time they would have been guaranteed positions as salesmen or estate agents or professionals, but such was not the case anymore. Therefore, it was hardly surprising that some were tipped over into a life of subterfuges and ultimately of criminality. Someone like Evelyn Waugh, for example, makes a joke about it, that bright young men find that palming diamonds in jewelers' stores is not an unthinkable thing to do. there's a sort of literary and I guess cinematic presentations of these new sorts of views as well, with the popularity of the theme of the jewel thief, the notion that something like stealing jewels is not quite the same as robbing banks, because the jewel thief, at least according to the myth, it has to be somebody who is intelligent, well-educated, can move with the best circles. And then in fact, they're stealing jewels is not really like stealing money, because who needs jewels? Aren't held by the working classes, they're only held by the wealthy. So the man who steals jewels is in a sense a type of Robin Hood. I mean, perhaps not giving to the poor, but certainly taking from the rich, who some people suggest aren't worthy of the jewels that they hold. So that the playboy again is a sort of figure who teeters on the margins between criminality and legitimacy. Again, someone who leads a life of excitement and provides a sort of a model of masculinity that counters the stress on rationality and domesticity.
Right, and part of their criminality, at least in the case of these four men in particular, sort of intersects very interestingly with the growing rise of fascism in Europe and fascism in Britain. And I thought that was a particularly interesting part of your book. And I was wondering sort of, you know, how, or I think a good question to ask would be, how do these men interact with these growing ideas of fascism, and how did that also sort of intersect with their criminality as well?
Yes, well, I think one of the fascinating aspects of this account is that when these young men and their friends and compatriots, when it's pushed forward into the 1940s, once war is declared in Europe, England never has to deal with the occupation of the country by the Germans. And so one never has a hard notion of how many people would have become explicitly fascists. There was always a tiny minority of the population that was supportive of the far right. but again, in some ways, the war saves the reputation of these playboys, because it allows them to live a life of derry-do and end up sometimes as war heroes, and other times as victims, as the war dead. But if it hadn't been for the war, many more of these young men probably would have ended up in prison or in jail. The fascists, determining what was fascistic and what wasn't, was a difficult undertaking. Evelyn Waugh, the noted novelist and humorist, a very conservative individual, protested against the use of the word fascist and held up for scrutiny the fact that leftists tend to toss the term around, saying that anything they didn't like was fascistic. And he, in saying this, he was responding to the fact that a number of the left-wing observers had declared that these four young men on the make, who had decided to enter a life of robbery, were in a sense fascists. And Waugh said this was simply not the case. But in fact, if one looks carefully at these histories of these young men, one finds that a number of them were all too eager to embrace fascism and present themselves as defenders of the right wing in Spain. Several of them tried to sell arms to Franco and declare that indeed that they had been in Spain themselves, fighting for the revolutionary government against the legitimate government. so that war goes too far in trying to purge the English of fear of fascism. In fact, he suggests that fascism or the tilt towards fascism is only caused by the growth of the left. It's a sort of blame the victim argument, that if only the left was less vociferous, then you wouldn't have fascism. So it's the left's responsibility for the chaos that's being undergone. Oswald Mosley, again, the head of the British Union of Fascists, you have a man who, again, interestingly enough, is a self-declared playboy. Or at least he says in his memoirs that when the war broke out, that is the First World War, he ceased being a playboy and then became a soldier. But others would have suggested that he never stopped being a playboy, which was, again, made all too evident by his self-centeredness, his narcissism, and his womanizing, all of which undercut the support that he had slowly been garnering in the mid-1930s.
Yeah, and a lot of the arguments that you sort of brought up from people at the time sort of certainly reverberate today, and I thought that was particularly interesting. So since we're kind of, I took up a lot of your time, so I, you know, just a couple concluding questions, but if somebody were to read your book and, you know, you have direct access to them after they get done reading, what would be sort of the one takeaway that you would hope that a reader would get from your book?
The notion of entitlement, I think, is quite central to the story, that someone has suggested that these men were suffering from what in America in the recently has been called affluenza, that there was a young man in the United States who claimed that his criminal activity was based on the fact that his parents were too wealthy. And it was an amazing sort of argument that this burden of cash drove him into criminal activities. And these young men whose careers I portrayed, again, were pushed in large part by this notion of entitlement, that they were owed somehow or another by their simple being a life of affluence. And but thinking it over again, of course, in the case of a monarchy such as Britain, you do have a political system in which the king or queen and the rest of their family enjoy their position of power, not because of anything that they've done or would do, certainly not because of their IQ or their abilities as being productive members of society, but simply because of who they are, that they've inherited, by birth they receive their rewards. And I think it's difficult to separate this general notion of the necessity of the utility of a royal family from that of the people that further down the social pyramid, feeling that they too share a similar sort of right to be taken care of.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And so if people are, you know, read your book and they find themselves really interested in the topic or the time period, are there any books that you would recommend them to check out next?
Well, I guess the first book, I should say unblushingly, is one of my own called, what is it called? A Prescription for Murder, which is a study of a serial killer in London of the 1890s. And in this case is an account of, first of all, the murderer, and then the reaction of the medical world to his activities. But coming, that book is about 20 years old. Coming up to date, I think the most important book that's come out recently that's comparable, perhaps, is Matt Holbrook's book called The Prince of Tricksters, which I haven't read it all through yet, but it is a brilliant account of one particular con man who was active in Britain in the 20s and 30s. And Holbrook, of course, is famous for his book on homosexual London, and this book is almost as good as that.
Well, those are some great recommendations, not only for our listeners, but for me as well. I might have to check those out. Dr. McLaren, thank you so much for joining us. And again, I would encourage everyone to check out Playboys and Mayfair Men, Crime, Class, Masculinity, and Fascism in 1930s London by John Hopkins University Press. Dr. McLaren, thank you so much.
Thank you.